Now that the Navy has allowed her to be used for civilian purposes, we have an incredible tool for pure research. I understand the sub was used in the Challenger space shuttle disaster, Pulaski said. Logan said she retrieved critical parts so NASA could determine what went wrong and make the shuttle safe to fly. She also salvaged a sunken F-14 and a missing Phoenix air-to-air missile we didn't want anyone getting their hands on. Some of the stuff involving the Russians is still classified. What can you tell me about the mechanical arm? Well, the manipulator works like a human arm, with rotation at all the joints. The sub has two rubber wheels in the keel. It's not exactly a Harley-Davidson motorcycle, but it allows us to move along the seabed. While the sub rests on the ocean floor, the arm can work a 9-foot radius. Fascinating, Pulaski said. And its capacity. It can lift objects up to 200 pounds. What about cutting tools? Its jaws can cut rope or cable, but they can also hold a torch if the job is tough. As I said, very versatile. Yes, evidently, Pulaski said. He seemed pleased. The sub had been moving in a classic search pattern, back and forth in a series of parallel lines like mowing a lawn. The monitors showed the seafloor moving beneath the submarine. Vegetation was non-existent. Logan said, "We should be closing in on the location we spotted from above." He gestured at a screen. "Hello. Looks like the side scan picked up a hit." He turned to the pilot. "Resume manual control and bring her down around 20 degrees to port." With gentle bursts of the thrusters, the NR-1 glided on a shallow angle. The battery of 24 exterior lights illuminated the sea bottom with a sun-bright intensity. The pilot adjusted ballast tanks until the sub achieved neutral buoyancy. "Hold steady," Logan said. "We're coming in visual contact with our target." He leaned forward and peered intently at the screen, his features bathed in the blue-green light. As the sub moved forward, bulbous shapes appeared on the screen, singly at first, then in groups. "Those are concentrations of amphorae," Pulaski said. The clay jars for wine or other liquid cargo were often found on ancient sunken ships. "We've got the still and video cameras making a three-dimensional record for you to analyze later," the captain said. "Is there anything you'd like to retrieve?" "Yes, that would be wonderful. Can we bring up an amphora? Maybe from that pile." Logan ordered the pilot to put the sub on the bottom near a pile of clay jars. The 400-ton vessel touched down like a feather and rolled forward. The captain called for the retrieval crew. Two crewmen came forward and lifted a hatch in the floor behind the control area. Beneath the hatch was a shallow well. A trio of 4-inch-thick acrylic viewing ports in the floor offered a view of the bottom. One man squeezed into the space and kept watch so the sub wouldn't run into a pile of jars. When the targets were within reach, the sub stopped. The manipulator arm was housed in the forward end of the keel box. Using a portable control panel, the man in the well extended the arm and worked the jaws. The arm rotated at the shoulder. The mechanical hand gently grabbed the jar around the neck, lifted and placed it in a storage basket below the bow. The arm was retracted, and Logan ordered the crew to raise the sub off the bottom. While the sub made another photo run, Logan called the support ship, described their find, and said they were about to surface, then ordered the sonar turned on to locate the support ship on the surface. A measured ping-ping echoed throughout the sub. "Prepare to surface," Logan told the pilot. Dr. Pulaski was standing directly behind the captain's chair. "I don't think so," he said. Preoccupied with the task at hand, Logan was only half listening. "Pardon me, Doctor, what did you say?"
"I said, we are not going to the surface."
Logan spun his chair around, an amused expression on his face. "I hope you didn't take my bragging about the ability to stay down for a month at face value.
We only brought enough food for a few days.
Pulaski slipped a hand under his windbreaker and pulled out a Tokarev TT-33 pistol. Speaking calmly, he said, "You will do as I say, or I will shoot your pilot." He brought the weapon around and placed the muzzle against the pilot's head. Logan's eyes focused on the gun, then darted to Pulaski's face. There was no hint of mercy in the rock-hard features. "Who are you?" Logan said.
"It makes no difference who I am.
I will repeat this only one more time. You will follow my orders."
"All right," Logan said, his voice hoarse with tension. "What do you want me to do?"
"First, switch off all communications with your support ship." Pulaski watched carefully as Logan clicked all the radio switches off.
"Thank you," he said, checking his watch.
"Next, inform the rest of the crew that the sub has been hijacked. Warn them that anyone who comes forward without permission will be shot."
The captain glared at Pulaski as he got on the internal communication system.
"This is the captain. There is a man with a gun in the control area. The sub is now under his command. We will do what he says. Stay out of the control area. This is not a joke. Repeat, this is not a joke. Remain at your posts. Anyone coming forward will be shot."
Startled voices could be heard coming from the aft section, and the captain issued the warning a second time to make sure his men knew he was serious.
"Very good," Pulaski said. "Now you will bring the sub up to the 500-foot level."
"You heard him," Logan said to the pilot, as if reluctant to give the direct order. The pilot had been frozen in his chair. At Logan's command, he reached for the controls and pumped water from the variable ballast tanks. Working the planes, he elevated the sub's nose and moved the NR-1 upward with short bursts of the main propulsion. At 500 feet, he leveled the sub off.
"Okay," Logan said. "Now what?" His eyes blazed with anger.
Pulaski glanced at his watch like a man worrying over a late train.
"Now we wait."
He shifted the gun away from the pilot, but kept it leveled and at ready. 10 minutes passed, then 15. Logan's patience was wearing thin.
"If you don't mind, could you tell me what we're waiting for?"
Pulaski put his finger to his lips. "You'll see," he said with a mysterious smile.
Several more minutes passed. The tension was suffocating. Logan stared at the sail cam monitor, wondering who this man was and what he wanted. And the answer was soon incoming. A huge shadow moved beyond the sharply pointed bow. Logan leaned forward and peered at the screen. "What the hell is that?"
The shadow glided under the sub like a monstrous shark coming up for a belly bite. A horrendous metal clang reverberated from one end of the sub to the other, as if the NR-1 had been slammed by a giant sledgehammer. The vessel shivered from the shock and rose several feet.
"We've been hit," the pilot yelled, instinctively reaching for the controls. "Stay where you are," Pulaski barked, bringing his gun to bear.
The pilot's hand froze in midair, and his eyes stared at the overhead. Those in the sub could hear scraping and dragging as if big metal bugs were crawling on the hull. Pulaski beamed with pleasure.
"Our welcoming party has arrived to greet us."
The noise continued for several minutes before it stopped, to be replaced by the vibration of powerful engines. The speed dial on the control panel began to move even though no power had been given to the thrusters.
"We're moving," the pilot said, his eyes glued to the speed indicator.
"What should I do?"
He turned to the captain. They were up to 10, then 20 knots, and still accelerating.
"Nothing," Pulaski answered.
Turning to Logan, he said,
"Captain, if you would give a message to your crew..."
"What do you want me to say?"
Pulaski smiled.
I think that is fairly obvious, he said. Tell them to sit back and enjoy the ride.
Chapter 3. The Black Sea. The 16-foot Zodiac inflatable boat sped toward the distant shore, its flat bottom thumping against the waves like a hand beating a tom-tom. Hunkered down in the bow, hands clutching the lifeline to keep from being bounced out, Kayla Dorn looked like a finely carved figurehead. The spray that splashed over the blunt prow stung her face, and her dusky features dripped with water, but she turned away only once, and that was to yell at the man who knelt in the boat with his hand on the tiller. Mehmet, crank this thing up! Crank it up! She made circular motions with her hand as if she were twirling a lariat. The wizened Turk answered with a toothless grin that was wider than his face. He goosed the throttle and the Zodiac porpoised over the next wave and slammed down with even greater gut-wrenching force. Kayla reinforced her grip on the lifeline and laughed with delight. The two men jouncing around in the boat like dice in a shaker were less enthusiastic. They held tight to keep from being thrown into the sea, their teeth clacking with every jolt. Neither passenger was surprised to hear Kayla tell Mehmet to kick up the speed. After 3 months of working with the young reporter on the Unbelievable Mysteries television series, they were accustomed to her recklessness. Mickey Lombardo, the crew's senior member, was a short, thick-set native New Yorker with arms made powerful from hefting sound and light equipment in and out of every conceivable means of transport around the globe. A wave had extinguished the cigar clenched between his teeth seconds after their wild ride began. His assistant, Hank Simpson, was a blonde and muscled Australian beach boy Lombardo had nicknamed Dundee. When they'd first learned that they would be working closely with the beautiful reporter, neither man could believe his good luck. That was before Kayla had led them through a dung-filled bat cave in Arizona, down the rapids in the green hell of the Amazon, and crashed a voodoo ceremony in Haiti. Lombardo said Kayla was living proof of the old axiom, be careful what you wish for, because you might get it. She'd turned out to be a cross between Amelia Earhart and Wonder Woman, and their libidos had diminished in direct proportion to their growing respect for her audacity. Instead of regarding Kayla as a potential conquest, they now guarded her like a precocious kid sister who had to be protected from her own impetuousness. Lombardo and Dundee could hardly be classified as shrinking violets themselves. The crews that worked for Unbelievable Mysteries had to be physically fit, aggressive in pursuing a story, and preferably brain dead. The cable TV series had a high turnover and injury rate. With its emphasis on high-risk adventures, the series was tough on production crews. In fact, the misadventures of the crews, rather than their main assignments, often became the topic of each episode. It was the logical continuation of the true-life adventure inspired by the success of the Survivor series and its clones. If a reporter or technician were swept into the sea or pursued by cannibals, it made for a better story. As long as a crew didn't lose expensive equipment, management didn't care how hazardous working conditions were. They had arrived in Istanbul a few days earlier to launch a search for Noah's Ark. The Ark was an overworked cliché that even the supermarket tabloids had consigned to the back section with Elvis sightings and the Loch Ness Monster. So, Kayla had kept a sharp eye out for other leads in case the Ark story didn't pan out. Their first day, while Kayla was looking for a fishing boat to take them into the Black Sea, she'd struck up a conversation with a colorful old Russian seaman she met on the docks. He had served on a Soviet missile sub and told her about an abandoned submarine base, even drew her a map showing the base's location in a remote corner of the Black Sea, after hinting that a gift of money might refresh his failing memory. When Kayla approached her colleagues and excitedly poured out the story of the abandoned Soviet submarine base, they lost no time planning a side trip.
The sub-base might make a good backup if the search for Noah's Ark fell apart, as it probably would. The fishing boat had been hired to take them to a rendezvous with a research vessel from the National Underwater and Marine Agency. Captain Kamal, the boat's owner, was paid by the day, and said he knew of the sub-base and would be happy to go there before they hooked up with the Numa vessel. However, the fishing boat had engine trouble as they neared the base, and the captain wanted to turn back to port. He'd had similar problems before, and it would take only a few hours to fix it once he had the part, but Kayla had persuaded him to drop her and the crew off and come back for them the next day. Mehmet, who was the captain's cousin, had volunteered to run them ashore in his Zodiac. Now the Zodiac was approaching a wide beach that rose gradually to a ridge of sand dunes. The waves grew higher and closer together, and Mehmet reduced their speed to half. The old Russian sailor had said that the base was underground, near an abandoned scientific station, and they would have to search for telltale air vents. Kayla wiped the water from her sunglasses and squinted toward the grassy hills, but saw no sign of human presence. The countryside was bleak and desolate, and she began to wonder if they had bitten off more than they could chew. The bean counters at UM frowned at unproductive expenditures. "See anything?" Lombardo shouted over the buzz of the outboard. "No billboards, if that's what you mean. Maybe this isn't the right place. Captain Kamal says this is it, and I have the map from the Russian. How much did you pay that scam artist for the map?"
$100.
Lombardo looked as if he had sucked on a lemon. "Wonder how many times he's sold the same map." Kayla pointed toward land. "That high spot over there looks promising." Thut! Kayla jerked her head back at the weird sound. Then she saw the ragged hole that had opened in the rubberized fabric a foot to the right of her head. She thought one of the many patches on the inflatable's skin had popped off from the beating the Zodiac was taking, and she turned to tail Mehmet. But the Turk had risen from his kneeling position, an odd expression on his face, his hand clutched to his chest. Then he crumpled, as if the air had gone out of him and pitched overboard. With no hand to steady the tiller, the boat went broadside and was caught by an incoming wave. The breaker lifted the boat at a sharp angle, when it was caught by another wave and flipped over, spilling the passengers into the sea. The sky whirled over Kayla's head, then cold water shocked her body. She went under a few feet, and when she came up, sputtering to the surface, the lights had gone out. She was under the overturned raft. She ducked her head and came up in the open. Lombardo's bald head bobbed up, then Dundee surfaced. "Are you okay?" she yelled, swimming closer. Lombardo spit out the remnants of his cigar. "What the hell happened?"
"I think Mehmet was shot."
"Shot? Are you sure?"
"He grabbed his chest and went over the side."
With Lombardo following, she swam over to the front of the boat. "This is where the first bullet hit, a second before the second one got Mehmet." "Geez," Lombardo said, sticking his finger in the hole. "Poor bastard." Dundee breaststroked over to join the other two, and they all drifted together, holding onto the raft. They agreed to stay with the raft where Kamal would find them, rather than risk going ashore. The Zodiac was low in the water, but some compartments still held air. Several times they tried to flip the boat over, but the weight of the outboard and the slipperiness of the rounded sides made it impossible. They were tiring fast, and the waves were pushing them ever closer to the beach. "That's it," Lombardo said, after an unsuccessful effort that left them all breathless. "Looks like we're going in after all."
"What if the guys who shot at us are still there?" Dundee said.
"You got a better suggestion?"
"The gunshots look as if they came from directly ahead," Kayla said. "Let's hide under the raft and move it off at an angle."
"We don't have a hell of a lot of choice," Lombardo said. He ducked underneath. When the other two joined him, he was smiling. "Look at this," he said, grabbing onto the waterproof bags that were suspended from the seats where they had been tied. "The cameras are okay." Kayla let out a whooping laugh that had a damp echo in the enclosed space.
What are we supposed to do if somebody points a gun at us, Mickey? Take their picture?
You'll have to admit it would make a good story. What do you think, Dundee? I think you two Yanks are bloody crazy.
But so am I, or I wouldn't be here with you.
Tell me, love, he said to Kayla. Didn't your Ruski friend say this place was abandoned?
He said the Russians had left a long time ago.
Maybe it's like one of those islands in the Pacific where the Japanese soldiers hid in the jungle, not knowing the war was over, Lombardo suggested. Maybe the guys here haven't heard the Cold War ended.
He was clearly excited at the prospect.
Sounds pretty far-fetched, Kayla said.
Yeah, I agree, but
do you have a better idea of who took the pot shots at us?
No, I don't, Kayla said. But if we don't start kicking, we're going to find out real soon. I'll check things out. She disappeared for a few moments. When she returned, she said, The beach looks deserted. I suggest we start moving this thing off to the right. Otherwise, we'll drift straight in.
They grabbed onto the boat and began to kick. The Zodiac moved, but the rollers pushed them toward shore. The muffled roar of waves breaking on the beach grew louder. No more gunshots came their way, and they began to hope that the shooters were gone. That optimism would have eroded quickly if they had been able to see beyond the grass crowning the dunes. A line of razor-sharp sabers was raised high in the sun, like the blades of a giant threshing machine, ready to cut them to ribbons as soon as they crawled ashore.
Chapter 4. High above the overturned Zodiac, a turquoise aircraft that resembled a winged canoe wheeled in a lazy circle. The broad-shouldered man at the controls rolled the ultralight airplane into a tight banking turn and peered down through tinted goggles, squinting against the reflected glare with eyes the color of coral underwater. His wind-burnished face was creased in a look of puzzlement. Moments before, he had seen swimmers in the water next to the overturned inflatable. He glanced away to get his bearings, and when he looked again, the swimmers were gone. Kurt Austin had been chasing the Zodiac like an aerial motorcycle cop, hot on the tail of a speeder, and seen the boat flip over. He couldn't figure out why it had gone out of control. The seas were moderate, and no rocks or other submerged objects were visible. Austin wondered if the inflatable or the fishing boat he had seen steaming away from the coast had anything to do with the television crew he was looking for. Probably not. The crew should be on its way to meet the NUMA survey ship, Argo, not heading for this desolate stretch. Austin was aboard the Argo as a deep ocean consultant on loan from his duties as leader of NUMA's special assignments team. The other members of the team, Joe Zavala and Paul and Gamay Trout, had been given different and non-demanding assignments in scattered projects around the globe. NUMA director James Sandecker had insisted that they take working vacations after the team had crossed swords with the hired killers of a mega corporation that wanted to take over the freshwater resources of the world. He had been particularly worried about Austin's attachment to a beautiful, brilliant Brazilian scientist who had sacrificed herself to bring down the conspiracy. The Argo was in the Black Sea, collecting information on wave and wind action for an international databank. With his master's degree in systems management from the University of Washington and his vast practical knowledge as a diver and undersea investigator, Austin had been invaluable in helping to set up the sophisticated remote sensing survey instruments. As the cruise had gone on and systems were set in place, however, his expertise became less necessary. He read some philosophy books he'd brought from his extensive library, but he started to grow bored and restless. The ship seemed like a prison surrounded by a very wide moat. Austin was aware that his psyche had been bruised and that Sandecker had his best interests at heart. But he needed strenuous physical and mental activity, not a cruise ship atmosphere. The serious scientists aboard the ship had been grumbling about the impending visit from the TV crew. They saw them as intruders who would interrupt their work with dumb questions. The fact that they were from a tabloid show on a mission to find Noah's Ark didn't add to their appeal. Austin's outlook was the exact opposite. He looked forward to their arrival as a diversion from his shipboard boredom. The television people had been due that morning, but they'd never arrived, and attempts to reach them by radio were unsuccessful. After lunch, Austin had climbed to the wheelhouse to run an idea past the skipper. The Argo's commander, Captain Joe Atwood, was clearly annoyed at the crew's failure to show up or contact his ship. He'd paced from one side of the bridge to the other, scanning the sea with binoculars. The Argo was supposed to be moving to another station, and the captain was unhappy about the delay. "Any word on our guests?" Austin said, although he knew from Atwood's dour expression what the answer would be. Atwood scowled at his watch. "I think they're lost," he declared sharply. "The next time those idiots in public affairs want me to entertain some crazy TV people, I'm going to tell them to stick their request where the sun don't shine." The captain was in no mood to be told that the job done by NUMA's public affairs department in proclaiming the agency's accomplishments helped loosen the congressional purse strings and attract grants for projects like the Black Sea Survey. "I've got a suggestion," Austin had volunteered. "I'm not busy. What say I take a spin around the neighborhood and see if I can spot them?" The captain's frown dissolved into a knowing grin. "You're not fooling me, Austin. You've wanted to get the Goonie into the air since the day you stepped aboard. It would serve a dual purpose. I could test fly the bird and look for our wayward guests at the same time. And it would be a perfect antidote for his developing case of cabin fever." Atwood ran his fingers through his pale red hair. "Okay, pal. Go for it. But keep us apprised of your position every few minutes. I've got enough trouble with those missing TV types. I don't want to chase you all over the Black Sea as well." Austin thanked the captain, and with a noticeable spring in his step, he went down to get the Goonie ready. The ultralight seaplane had been developed as a way to extend a boat's visual reach. The radar that most NUMA ships carried could pick up a gnat at 10 miles, but at times there was no substitute for the human eye. Joe Zavala, whose mechanical mind bordered on brilliant, had designed the aircraft. Zavala had asked Austin to take the plane aboard the Argo to test it under real-life conditions, but the ship had been on the go for most of its mission, and Austin had been reluctant to ask the captain for time to make a test flight. The single-seat plane was named after the Goonie Bird, the nickname sailors gave the albatross, a seabird known for its exquisite beauty in flight and clumsiness taking off and landing. Austin inspected the aircraft in its deck hangar. The stubby, ungainly appearance didn't bother him. Austin had flown ultralights before, and what was important were stability and ease of operation. The letters NUMA were painted in black on the side. The flat-bottomed fiberglass hull had an upturned canoe nose, and fiberglass floats supported by aluminum struts hung from both sides of the hull. Attached to the floats and flanking the hull was the manually operated retractable landing gear that allowed the Goonie to set down on waterways or runways. The plane was hauled out onto the deck, and its narrow, 30-foot Dacron-covered wings were unfolded and locked in place. Austin eased into the snug cockpit, and some of the Argo's crew pushed the Goonie down the ship's broad, slanting stern ramp into the sea. Austin started the power plant, threw off the safety line, and taxied to open water to get the feel of the controls. The aircraft handled well on water, and he decided to see what it would do in the air. He pointed the Goonie down an imaginary airstrip and gave it the throttle. Powered by the compact 40-horsepower engine, the Goonie got on plane quickly with no skidding. The aircraft skimmed the wave tops for about 100 feet, then lifted into the air and climbed until it was above the survey ship. Austin circled the Argo once, tipped his wings in salute, then headed on a line toward the Bosporus Strait that connected the Black Sea with the Mediterranean. He reasoned that the TV people based in Istanbul would be coming from that direction. The Rotax two-stroke twin-cylinder engine driving the rear-mounted propeller could push the blunt-nosed plane at a top speed of 65 miles per hour. Not exactly supersonic, but the plane handled like a dream, turning, climbing, and diving without a hint of a stall. Austin felt as free as the seabirds he'd seen wheeling high above the Argo in search of scraps from the galley. He flew at about 1,000 feet, an altitude that allowed him to see miles in every direction, cruising at 55 miles per hour. The 5-gallon tank gave the plane a range of about 150 miles. The air was as clear as fine crystal, and the bright sun cast a silvery sheen on the rippled surface of the water. He set up a rough search pattern, running a series of parallel lines that would cover the greatest amount of territory in the shortest time. The TV people had sent a short radio message before they'd left Istanbul, requesting the Argo's position and giving their estimated time of arrival. They said they would be traveling on a fishing boat. Austin saw a number of trawlers, but none appeared to be on a direct course for the Argo. The back-and-forth flight pattern quickly used up his fuel. He was down to a third of a tank, enough to get back to the ship with a narrow margin of error. He checked his compass and was about to turn back to the ship when he spotted the wake of a boat approaching the Russian coast at a high rate of speed. Curiosity got the best of him, and he decided to make a swing close to land. He brought the Goonie down so that he was flying less than 500 feet over the water and had almost caught up with the boat, when suddenly it had been caught by a wave and flipped over. As Austin circled, pondering his next step, he noticed that the capsized inflatable was behaving oddly. Although it was caught in the pull of waves, it was moving toward shore at an angle. Austin picked up his microphone and clicked the on button. "Goonie to Numa ship Argo. Come in, please."
"Argo here."
Austin recognized the voice of the ship's captain.
"How's the little seabird handle?" Atwood said.
"Like a trained pterodactyl. She practically flies herself. I'm just along for the ride."
"Glad to hear that. Any sign of those unbelievable TV idiots from Unbelievable Mysteries?"
Keeping his eye on the boat below, Austin said, "The only mystery out here is an overturned Zodiac. I saw some people hanging on to it, but they're gone."
"What's your position?"
"I'm right off the coast." Austin scanned a craggy point of land that jutted into the sea. "I'm looking at some medium-high sea cliffs with a beach and dunes in between them. There's a rock profile on a headland that reminds me of Admiral Sandecker's profile. Beard and all."
"I'll ask the navigator. He's sailed these waters hundreds of times."
After a pause, the voice came back.
"That's Imam's Point. Supposedly the face of an old holy man."
The boats drifted into the surf line. "Too rough for me to set down at sea."
"What do you want us to do?"
"I'm going down for a peek. I'm going to need help if I find anyone. The Goonie wasn't made to carry passengers."
"We're on our way. ETA in about an hour."
"Roger. We'll land and see if I can find a bar that serves a decent Stole martini." Austin clicked off the mic and checked the boat again. He smiled tightly. He hadn't been imagining things. Three swimmers had broken away from the Zodiac and were stroking toward the beach. The ultralight landed best into the wind, which was coming off the water. Austin dropped down to 100 feet and headed toward shore, setting his sights on a long, rolling dune overlooking the beach. He intended to make a U-turn over the dune and bring the aircraft down lightly onto the sand. The Goonie flew over the figures, struggling through the surf. The swimmers were making good progress, riding the crests to save their strength. Austin had a brief glimpse of some low-lying buildings inland, but a brilliant flash of light from the ground caught his eye. The Goonie could turn on a dime.
Taking advantage of its quick handling, Austin pushed the rudder control. The plane seemed to spin in mid-air, and he had a clear view of the shallow valley behind the dune. Hidden behind the dune were a dozen mounted men spread out in a single line with swords held high in the air. The silvery red brightness Austin had seen was the sun reflecting off the sword blades. The Goonies' sudden and noisy appearance startled the horses, however, and they milled around in fright while the riders fought to bring them under control. Austin caught only a glimpse of the scene as he passed directly overhead, then he was above the beach again. The swimmers were only moments from shore. Suddenly, pieces of Dacron began flying past his face. The horsemen were carrying more than swords. The wing over Austin's head looked as if a tiger was sharpening its claws in the fabric. Someone on the beach was shooting at him. The thin fiberglass cockpit was no protection against bullets. Even worse, Austin was practically sitting on the Goonies' gas tank. The shots were high, but one lucky round in the propeller would drop him like a wounded duck. He pushed forward on the stick, and the plane dove. Even wearing earphones, he heard the sharp thwack of a bullet striking one of the hollow aluminum struts that connected the cockpit to the wings. He felt a sharp sting on his right temple. A splinter of flying metal had hit him, and blood was trickling down his face. He was wearing a neckerchief, and he pulled it up around his forehead to catch the blood. The same volley that had hit the strut had shattered a fiberglass wing float. Austin jammed the stick as far forward as it would go, and the ultralight dropped like a runaway elevator and tilted dangerously, the plane thrown off balance by the loss of the float. Austin had to compensate by leaning his weight to one side. He flew out to sea until he was out of range, then put the plane into a turn that took him parallel to the shore. The swimmers had hit the sand on their bellies when the gunfire broke out. Now they were up again and running along the water's edge. He picked out a slim, dark-skinned woman and two men, one short and the other tall. As they ran, they glanced over their shoulders, trying to keep an eye on the Goonie, only to see the mounted men crest the dune with swords raised. Spurred on by the new threat, the trio dug their feet in, but it was impossible to run faster in the soft sand. The mounted men would make short work of the defenseless runners caught between them and the deep blue sea. The open expanse of beach offered no shelter. It was a perfect killing field. The horsemen spurred their mounts and galloped along the dune to outflank their prey. Austin reached into an emergency chest behind his seat and pulled out the Orion 25mm signal kit for offshore boats. He fit one of the 10,000 candle-power red meteors into the pistol launcher. Then he cranked up the throttle to full speed. Wobbling dangerously because of the damage, the Goonie hurtled toward the beach at 65 miles per hour. The runners dove onto their bellies again as the ultralight buzzed overhead like a large, angry hornet. Austin was operating on pure reflex, more machine than man. Holding the control stick between his knees, he leaned around the curved plexiglass sheet that served as a windshield and sighted on the center of the mounted line. He squeezed the trigger, and the flare streaked toward the horseman like a miniature comet. The awkward angle of the aircraft threw Austin's aim off. The missile struck the dune a few feet below the grassy crest and exploded in a bright scarlet shower. The horses nearest to the fiery burst reared in panic. Those animals that managed to maintain their calm lost it as the plane grazed their heads like a giant buzzing insect. Austin made a quick turn for a second run. The chaotic scene atop the dune reminded him of the famous Picasso mural, Guernica. It was hard to know where the horses ended and their riders began. He smiled grimly and slid another flare into the launch gun. Again he came in, attacking from the rear this time. A ragged hole surrounded by a lacework of cracks appeared in the windshield. One of the riders had gotten off a lucky shot. Austin felt the bullet whistle by his ear. He made a superhuman effort to keep a grip on his concentration as he aimed the pistol and squeezed the trigger. The second flare streaked toward the confusing mass of horse and human bodies and slammed into a rider with a burst of red phosphorus. He fell from his horse and was dragged off with one foot still caught in the stirrup. The beach flashed by in a blur, and again Austin was out to sea. He came around at an angle until he was behind the dune once more. The grass was on fire, and black smoke billowed into the sky. Riders who had been thrown by their mounts were trying to roll out of the way to avoid being trampled. Others had dismounted and held tightly to the reins as they tried to calm the terrified animals. The horses bumped into one another, and the contact only served to increase their terror. A lone horseman broke away from the others and put his mount into a gallop. Kayella and her friends heard the thunder of hooves and turned to see the rider bearing down on them with sword held high. Austin swung around until he was facing the horseman. He brought up the flare gun, but had a problem keeping it steady for proper aim. Instead, he put the goonie into a low dive that took him a few feet above the heads of the runners and aimed directly at the horseman, a big man with a flowing red beard. At the last second, Austin pulled up. The float missed the man's head by inches. The horse whinnied in terror and broke into a wild run. The rider struggled to hang on as the horse took matters into its own hooves, climbed the dune, and chased after the other riders, who had lost their stomach for the attack and were galloping for the woods. Meanwhile, Austin fought a losing battle to keep the damaged plane level. He sat half out of the cockpit, like someone hiking out on an angled sailboat, gritted his teeth, and braced himself for the hard landing that he knew was coming. Chapter 5 Kayla Dorn held her breath as the strange little aircraft plunged from the sky in a spiraling tailspin. At the last second, the plane swung up in a wild G-force swoop. It soared and dipped like a kite on a swing, then leveled off, although the wings quivered and the aircraft pitched and yawed as if it were on an invisible roller coaster. The pilot finally brought the plane under a semblance of control and put it in a landing glide. He held it steady, but before he could touch down, the left wing dipped sharply and dug into the soft sand. The wing snapped off where it joined the fuselage, and the plane slammed into the beach at an angle, skidding several yards before it came to a jarring halt, tail section high in the air. The engine shut down, and the beach was suddenly quiet, except for the lap of waves and the crackle of burning grass. The reporter and her colleagues stared like zombies at the plane wreck. They were too exhausted to move, drained by their swim to shore, still panting from the run for their lives. Kayla was in the best shape of the three, and her legs felt like putty. When the stubby plane had first appeared, they hadn't known whether it was friend or foe, but there had been no question as to the intentions of the horsemen with their wild yells and drawn swords. They had been out for blood. The plane looked like a bird that had flown into a fan, and it seemed impossible that its pilot could have escaped without harm. But someone moved in the cockpit. The pilot got one leg, then another, over the cockpit combing and climbed out. He seemed to be all right as he walked around the aircraft, hands on hips, inspecting the damage. He kicked a buckled wheel as if he were checking out a used car and shook his head. Then he turned to the television crew, gave them a friendly wave, and started in their direction, walking with a slight limp. Lombardo and Dundee moved in and stood protectively at Kayla's sides. She was more interested in appraising the stranger. He was tall, slightly over 6 feet, and the broad, powerful shoulders of a nightclub bouncer filled out the navy sweatshirt. He wore tan shorts, and his muscular legs looked as if they could propel the husky body through a brick wall. As he came closer, he removed his baseball cap to reveal his steel-gray, almost platinum hair. His bronzed face was unlined, except for laugh crinkles around the eyes and mouth. She guessed his age at around 40. Dried blood dripped down one cheek and soaked the bandana around his forehead. The aircraft landing must have been hair-raising, yet he seemed as if he were coming off a game of tennis.
"Good afternoon," he said, with a wide grin. "Are you folks okay?"
"Yes, we're fine, thank you," Kayla replied warily.
"What about you? You're bleeding."
He touched the wound absentmindedly. "It's only a little cut. I'm still in one piece, more or less." He jerked his thumb at the battered ultralight.
"Wish I could say the same for my transportation. They just don't make them like they used to.
You don't happen to have a roll of duct tape?"
Kayla ventured a smile. "Your plane has gone beyond the duct tape stage," she said. "I believe the term insurance people use is totaled." The stranger grimaced.
"I'm afraid you're right, Ms.
Dorn. Kayla Dorn. This is my producer, Mickey Lombardo, and his assistant, Hank Simpson. We're with the Unbelievable Mysteries television series."
"I thought so. My name is Kurt Austin. I'm with Numa."
"Numa?"
Lombardo stepped forward and pumped Austin's hand.
"Boy, are we glad to see you. Lucky you came by."
"It was more than luck," Austin said. "I've been looking for you folks. You were supposed to rendezvous with the Argo this morning."
"Sorry about that," Lombardo said. "We took a detour to check out an old Russian submarine base that's supposed to be around here."
"The captain of the Argo isn't too happy. You've delayed his departure schedule. It might have saved us some grief if you had let us know that your plans had changed."
Austin was smiling, but the gentle, scolding tone of his voice was unmistakable.
"It's my fault," Kayla said. "We thought we'd only be a few hours. We intended to call you at sea, but the fishing boat we hired didn't have a workable radio. The captain had to return to port for engine repairs, and he planned to get the radio fixed and give you a call."
"That must be the fishing boat I saw steaming away from here."
She nodded.
"He was going to pick us up in the morning. Thank you for saving our lives. I apologize for putting you through so much trouble."
"No trouble," he said, reluctant to chastise the bedraggled group any further. He gazed at the wrecked aircraft.
"Maybe a little trouble. What made your boat capsize?"
"Someone on shore shot at us and killed the Turkish man who was bringing us in," Kayla said. "A wave caught us broadside and the boat went over. We hid under the Zodiac and tried to move it away from the beach, but the surf was too strong and we came almost straight in."
She glanced toward the dune where she had first seen the attackers.
"Do you know who those men on horseback were?"
Austin didn't reply. Although he seemed to be studying her face, Kayla became aware that her wet t-shirt and shorts clung to her lithe figure. She self-consciously plucked at the sand-caked front of the shirt, but the fabric insisted on plastering itself to her skin. Austin sensed her discomfiture and stared off at the smoke rising from the dune.
"My guess is that they weren't the local equestrian group out for a jaunt," he said. "Let's take a look."
He climbed up the sloping beach with the others trailing tentatively behind. The fire had almost burned itself out. They walked through the charred stalks of grass at the top of the dune. Austin saw sunlight glinting off something on the ground and went over to investigate. It was a saber. He picked the weapon up and tested the heft and balance. The sword's long, curved blade was perfectly weighted to give the arm greater striking power. Austin's jaw muscles clenched as he contemplated the terrible damage the scalpel's sharp edge could inflict on human flesh. He was examining the Cyrillic writing etched into the blade when the Australian called out. Dundee was standing in a knee-high patch of unburned grass, staring at something at his feet.
"What is it?" Austin said.
"Dead guy."
Austin stuck the saber point into the sand and waded through the thatch.
Dundee pointed to the body of a man who lay on his back, glassy eyes locked in a death stare. A black beard and mustache, matted with sand, hid most of his features. He could have been in his 40s. His head was twisted at a wrong angle. Blood soaked one side of his face, which had a caved-in look to it. Austin said, "I'd guess he fell off his horse during the fight and was kicked in the head." He was not a callous man, but he felt no pity for the dead horseman. Lombardo had retrieved his camera from the beached Zodiac and was filming the battle site. He and Kayla came over to see what the others were looking at. Lombardo let out a low whistle. "What kind of get-up is that?" Austin knelt by the body. "Looks like something out of the Wizard of Oz." The dead man wore a long, muddy gray coat that buttoned up the front and baggy pants tucked into black boots. His black fur pillbox hat lay a few feet away. Red epaulets decorated each shoulder. A pistol holster and scabbard hung from the wide leather belt that encircled his waist. Slung across his chest was a cartridge belt. A sheathed dagger hung from a cord around his neck. "Good day," Dundee said with wonderment. "The man's a walking arsenal." Austin searched the grass around the dead man. A few yards away, he found a rifle, and he put the stock against his shoulder and worked the well-oiled bolt. Like the saber blade, the barrel was etched with Cyrillic writing. Austin was a collector of dueling pistols, and he had accumulated a general knowledge of antique guns. The rifle was a Mosin Nagant, more than 100 years old and in mint condition. He uttered a silent prayer of thanks that the horsemen weren't carrying modern automatic weapons. A single Kalashnikov would have ripped him and the goonie to shreds. Austin handed the rifle off to Dundee and went through the dead man's pockets. Nothing. He unpinned the metal starburst emblem from the front of the hat and pocketed it. Lombardo had finished filming the battle scene, and Kayla suggested shooting some footage around the one-story cinderblock buildings farther inland. "Not a good idea," Austin said, pointing to the trail of hoof prints leading toward the structures. He'd been worried that the horsemen would make a return appearance, but hadn't said anything because there wasn't much they could do about it. "In fact, I'd suggest that we get out of here as soon as we can." He rested the rifle on his shoulder, retrieved the saber, and started walking back toward the beach. Kayla caught up with him on the crest of the dune. "Do you have any idea what this is all about?" she said breathlessly. "Why these men would want to kill us?" "You know as much as I do. I thought they were filming a movie until somebody took a few shots at me." "It's a good thing for us that their aim was bad." She paused. Austin was studying her face the way he had earlier. "Is there anything wrong?" "I'm almost embarrassed to say." "I find it hard to believe that you'd be embarrassed. You hardly seem the shy type." Austin shrugged. "Well, in a manner of speaking, you might say we've met before." "Sorry, I'm sure I would have remembered. Not literally. Believe me when I say this. You bear a striking resemblance to the face of a princess I once saw painted on the wall of an Egyptian temple." Kayla was tall, with a good part of her height invested in long, shapely legs. She had a smooth mocha complexion and ebony black hair that she kept long with a natural tight curl. Her mouth was full and almost perfect, and her eyes were a dark amber. As an attractive woman working in a man's profession, she thought she had heard every male line invented. But this was a new one. She gave Austin a sidelong glance. "That's funny. I was thinking that you looked as if you'd fallen off Captain Kidd's pirate ship." Austin laughed and ran his fingers through his disheveled hair. "I suppose I do look like a pirate, but I'm not joking. You're a ringer for the young woman in the temple. You're quite a bit younger than she is, though.
I believe her portrait dates back to about 4,000 BC.
I've been called a lot of things, she said, but never an Egyptian mummy.
Thanks for the compliment, if that's what it was, and for saving our necks. There's no way we can ever repay you, Mr. Austin. You can start by calling me Kurt, and may I call you Kayla?
She smiled. Of course.
Now that we're old friends, how about being my guest at dinner?
She glanced up and down the deserted coast.
What did you have in mind? Something out of the Boy Scout handbook? Roots and berries?
I only made it as far as Cub Scouts, and foraging was never my forte.
I was thinking more of something like duck à l'orange. I can almost guarantee a table with a water view.
Here, she said, going along with the game.
No, there. He pointed out to sea where a turquoise-hulled ship could be seen steaming in their direction. Casa Argo. They say the chef used to work at the Four Seasons before Numa stole him.
My mother didn't raise any stupid kids, Kayla said. I'd be a fool to refuse an invitation like that.
Conscious of her unkempt state, she said, I don't think I'm dressed for a fancy dinner. I'm sure we can find something appropriate aboard the ship. I'll ask when I call for reservations. My radio's the only thing that wasn't smashed when I landed. Maybe you can round up your friends while I hail the boat. But you might want to hurry them along. We're on Russian territory, and I don't have my passport. We shouldn't overstay our welcome.
Kayla followed Austin with her eyes as he made his way back to the damaged ultralight. She sensed a story. Who was this guy? This was no nerd.
She called out to Mike and Dundee and told them to wrap up their filming.
Then she hurried to catch up with Austin.
Chapter 6. Moscow, Russia. Wielding iron self-control, Viktor Petrov replaced his telephone in its cradle, tented his fingers, and stared into space. After a moment lost in thought, he rose from his desk and went to the window. As he gazed out at the city, letting his eyes linger on the turnip-shaped spires of St. Basil's in the distance, his hand came up and brushed his right cheek. He hardly felt the touch of his fingers through the parchment-like scar tissue that covered the dead nerve endings in his skin. How long had it been? 15 years. Strange. After all that time, a single phone call brought back memories of the searing pain. Petrov watched the crowds of pedestrians swarming in the summer heat and yearned for winter. Like many of his countrymen, he had a poignant attachment to snow. The Russian winter was harsh and unforgiving, but it had protected the country from the armies of Napoleon and Hitler. Petrov's love of snow was more prosaic as well. Winter covered the city's flaws, hushed its noise, and hid its corruption under a white blanket of purity. He returned to his battered metal desk, the largest object in the small, drab room. At one elbow was an old-fashioned black dial telephone. At the other, a fax machine. An empty filing cabinet stood in a corner, there mainly for show. The cramped office was one of dozens of cubicles that made up the 10th floor warren of the agricultural building, a soaring gray monument to the banality of socialist architecture. Printed in small letters on the door were the words, Siberian Pest Control. Petrov rarely had visitors. Occasionally a lost soul blundered into the office, only to be told that Siberian Pest Control had moved. In spite of his Spartan surroundings, Petrov exerted wide power in the Russian government. The key to his influence was the anonymity that kept him from view.
He remembered the old days when Pravda had dutifully printed photos of the Soviet hierarchy reviewing the May Day parade from Lenin's tomb. Any hint that someone in a lineup was a possible successor to the reigning tyrant of the day marked the unfortunate individual for liquidation. Petrov had mastered the art of fading into the woodwork. He was the bureaucratic equivalent of a shapeshifter, a legendary being that can change form at will. He had survived 3 premiers and countless Politburo members with his ability to avoid definition. He hadn't allowed himself to be photographed in years. The photos clipped to his personnel files were of dead men. He resisted attempts to give him a title. In the various evolutions of his long career, he was known simply as an aide. In keeping with his facade, Petrov enclosed his athletic physique in one of the baggy monotone suits that had long been the uniform of the Kremlin's faceless gray men. His pepper and salt hair was worn over the collar of his cheap shirt as if he could not afford a regular haircut. The glass in his wire-rimmed spectacles was plain and intended to give him a professional look. Disguise had its limitations, though. He could cover his scar, but no sartorial sleight of hand could hide the lively intelligence that glinted in the slate-blue eyes, and his chiseled profile projected a ruthless determination. The caller was an earnest young man named Alexei, whom Petrov had personally recruited as an agent. "There is a new development in the south," he said, making no effort to hide his excitement. The 4 cardinal directions had become a rough, verbal shorthand in alerting Petrov to the general location of trouble in the vortex of assassinations, murders, rebellions, and unrest that swirled around in the far corners of the old Soviet Empire. Petrov thought he was about to hear more bad news from the Republic of Georgia. "Go ahead," Petrov said automatically. "An American ship violated Russian territory in the Black Sea earlier today." "What sort of ship?" Petrov said, with barely disguised irritation. Far more weighty matters occupied his mind. "It was a survey vessel from the National Underwater and Marine Agency."
"Numa?"
Petrov tightened his grip on the phone. "Go on," he said, trying to keep his voice level.
"Our observers identified the vessel as the Argo. I checked on the ship's permit. The vessel is only allowed to conduct operations in the open sea. Several communications were picked up between the ship and an aircraft. The pilot of the plane indicated his intention to enter Russian territory."
"Did the plane actually cross our borders?"
"We don't know, sir. There were no radar sightings."
"Well, this is not exactly an invasion, Alexei. Is it not a matter that should be taken up with the U.S. State Department?"
"Not in this case, sir. The plane gave its positions, so we were able to chart its course. It was flying near Department 331 when the pilot made plans to rendezvous with the ship."
Petrov's lips parted in a silent curse.
"You're certain of their position?"
"Absolutely."
"Where is the Numa ship now?"
"The Coast Guards dispatched a helicopter to the scene. The ship has left Russian territorial waters and appears to be on its way to Istanbul. We are continuing to monitor radio messages."
"What about the aircraft?"
"No sign of it."
"There was a thorough visual inspection of their landing site, I assume?"
"Yes, sir. The landing party reported seeing about an acre of burned grass. There were many footprints and evidence of horses."
"Horses?"
Petrov had the feeling someone had walked on his grave.
"I want you to follow the progress of the ship. If it makes port, place it under 24-hour surveillance. alert me to any development that has to do with this vessel.
Yes, sir.
Is that all?
Send me the printed conversations between the pilot and ship.
I'll do that immediately.
Petrov praised the agent for his thoroughness and hung up. The fax machine hummed a few minutes later and spat out several sheets of paper. Petrov studied the double-spaced transcript of the conversation between the Argo's captain and the man in the aircraft. His fingers stiffened as he read the first sentence. Austin to Argo.
Austin. It couldn't be.
Petrov took a deep breath to steady his nerves. Austin was a common name in the United States, and NUMA was a large organization. He tried to persuade himself that it was sheer coincidence, but as he read the transcript, his lips curled into a grim smile. There was no mistaking the pilot's wise-cracking tone. The irreverent reference to the director of NUMA clinched it. He was reading pure Kurt Austin. Petrov reached into a dusty file cabinet and extracted a thick folder marked NUMA, Kurt Austin. The dossier's well-worn pages told him what he already knew by heart. Austin had been born in Seattle, his father, the wealthy owner of a marine salvage company. The sea had shaped his adventurous personality. He could sail as soon as he could walk, and as he grew older, he acquired a taste for racing speedboats, although in recent years he had taken up sculling on the Potomac. He lived in a converted boathouse below the Palisades in Washington, D.C., less than a mile from the Central Intelligence Agency at Langley. He enjoyed philosophy, collected dueling pistols, listened to progressive jazz. Petrov read further, though his eyes barely registered the words. After studying for his master's in systems management at the University of Washington, Austin had attended a highly rated Seattle dive school and trained as a professional. He'd brought these skills to bear working on North Sea oil rigs, then returned to his father's salvage company before being lured into government service by a little-known branch of the CIA that specialized in underwater intelligence gathering. At the end of the Cold War, the CIA had closed down the branch, and NUMA Director Admiral James Sandecker had hired Austin to head up a special assignments team being assembled for oceanographic research. Their backgrounds couldn't have been more different, Austin and Petrov. Like the American, Petrov had salt water in his veins, but his beginnings were more humble. He'd been born the only son of a poor fisherman. As a young pioneer, his intelligence and athletic ability were noticed by a visiting political commissar, and he was taken to Moscow and made a ward of the state. He never saw his parents or siblings again. Even worse, he didn't care to see them. The Soviet state had become his new family. He attended the finest Soviet schools, excelling in engineering, served a stint in the KGB as a submarine officer, and later moved to naval intelligence. Like Austin, Petrov had also served in a little-known ocean intelligence branch. Unlike Austin's group, which concentrated on oceanographic research, Petrov's people were authorized to carry out their duties by any means, including force. Their paths had first crossed after an Israeli submarine clandestinely sank an Iranian container ship carrying nuclear weapons. Petrov was ordered to retrieve the weapons at all costs. The container ship could be an embarrassment because the weapons had been stolen from the Soviet arsenal. Meanwhile, the U.S. was performing a balancing act between its Arab allies and Israel, and Washington had worried that if Iran knew how the ship had been sunk, they would declare a holy war that would spread around the region. Austin had been made the director of an attempt to salvage the container ship and destroy the evidence. Ships from the USSR and the U.S. had arrived over the sunken container ship at about the same time. Neither ship would give way to the other. The standoff dragged on for days. Warships from both countries hovered on the horizon. It was a tense time.
Petrov was awaiting orders from Moscow when he was called to the bridge to hear a message from the American ship. "This is the U.S. vessel Talon calling unknown Soviet salvage ship. Come in, please." The caller spoke in heavily accented Russian. "Soviet salvage ship to Talon," Petrov replied in the American accented English he had learned at the state schools. "Do you mind if we speak in English?" the American said. "My Russian is a little rusty." "No problem. I assume you called to let us know you will be moving off-site." "No, actually I called to check on your caviar supply." Petrov smiled. "It is more than adequate, thank you. Now let me ask a question. When will your ship be departing?" "Your command of English isn't as good as I thought. We have no intention of leaving international waters." "Then the responsibility for any repercussions will be on your head." "Sorry, we're not accepting repercussions." "Then we have no alternative but to force the situation." "Let's see if we can settle this thing amicably, Tavarich," the American replied casually. "We both know what's on that wreck and what a pain it could cause our respective countries. So, here's my suggestion. We pull back while you go down and retrieve your, stolen property. We'll even give you a hand if you'd like. When you're finished with your salvage work, you leave, and we'll dispose of the evidence. What do you say?"
"Interesting proposition."
"I think so.
How do I know I can trust you?"
"Action speaks louder than words. I've given the order to move back a half mile." Petrov watched the American ship lift anchor and reposition itself farther from the salvage site. Petrov judged that despite the American's lighthearted manner, he was determined to carry out his mission. The alternative to a deal was an escalation of force. Petrov was no gambler. If the American reneged, Petrov could use the armed men on his ship and the Soviet Navy was on call. No matter what the outcome, however, he would not look good for letting the confrontation get out of control.
"Very well," he said. "Once we are finished with our salvage, we will leave, and you may move in."
"Fair enough. What's your name, by the way? I'd like to know whom I'm dealing with." The question caught Petrov off guard. In a sense, he had no name, having been given one by the Soviet government. He chuckled and said, "You may call me Ivan." His answer was greeted by a deep laugh. "I'll bet half the guys on your ship are named Ivan." "Okay. You can call me John Doe." He wished Petrov good luck in Russian and hung up. Petrov lost no time sending divers down to the container ship. The torpedo blast hole allowed for relatively easy access to the hull, and two nuclear devices were extracted. There were a few dicey moments when currents snagged the lifting line, but they worked on rotating shifts and got the job done in less than 24 hours. Petrov ordered the ship to move out and signaled the Americans. The vessels passed within a few hundred yards of each other, going in opposite directions. Petrov stood on the deck and looked through binoculars at the American vessel.